This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Hamas negotiators will remain in Cairo for another day at the request of mediators, keeping ceasefire talks going after 2 days with no breakthrough. An official from the militant group said on Tuesday. Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan provides more details.
The Cairo talks had been billed as a final hurdle to reach the war's first extended ceasefire. It would be a 40-day truce between Israel and Hamas, during which dozens of Israeli hostages would be freed, and aid would be pumped into Gaza to stave off a famine. Three security sources from host and mediator Egypt told Reuters the warring sides still wanted a deal, but still sticking to demands that had held up an agreement so far. Israel says it is interested only in a temporary truce, during which more hostages would be freed. Hamas says it wants any deal to lead to a permanent end to hostilities.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Chan. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken discussed with Israeli War Cabinet member Benny Gantz in a meeting Tuesday the need to act urgently to enable the delivery of humanitarian aid. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller told reporters this Tuesday.
Secretary Blinken and Minister Gantz also discussed efforts to reach an agreement for a six-week ceasefire that would secure the release of all hostages and help alleviate the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Miller added obstacles to a Gaza ceasefire are not insurmountable. He said in Washington's view, it is possible to reach an agreement between Israel and Hamas. A U.S. destroyer shot down drones in a missile launch by Yemen's Houthi rebels toward the Red Sea. That's according to the U.S. Military Central Command. The assault Tuesday targeted the USS Kearney, an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. The rebels claimed the attack, though they said they targeted two American warships without elaborating. Meanwhile, the Indian Navy released footage of its sailors fighting a fire aboard a container ship. This is VOA News. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Tuesday welcomed the International Criminal Court's arrest warrants for two top Russian commanders for suspected war crimes in Ukraine. VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The International Criminal Court said Tuesday that there were reasonable grounds to believe that Sergei Kobylash and Viktor Sokolov were responsible for missile strikes by forces under their command against the Ukrainian electric infrastructure. This is Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. These are obvious crimes, Russia's war crimes and crimes against humanity. And it is precisely in this regard that the International Criminal Court made a principled move. The ICC said the attacks on Ukraine's electrical grid caused civilian harm and damage that would have been clearly excessive to any expected military advantage. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
Haiti's embattled prime minister landed in Puerto Rico as he tries to return to Haiti to quell a surge in violent gang attacks. Officials told the Associated Press that Ariel Henry landed late Tuesday at the international airport in the capital of San Juan. The official spoke on condition of anonymity. Henry was expected to travel to the Dominican Republic later to fly to Haiti, but the government of the Caribbean nation closed its air borders as gangs in Haiti continued to escalate their attacks on key targets like prisons and the main international airport. Venezuela has announced that its highly anticipated presidential election will take place July 28th, but the country's leading opposition candidate remains barred from the ballot. President Nicolas Maduro is widely expected to run for re-election. His government initially negotiated details of the task of the election with a faction of the opposition, but differences between both sides have deepened over the past 2 months. The chosen date is months ahead of the opposition's preferred December date. That date announced by National Electoral Council President Elvis Omoroso did, however, meet at least one key opposition demand that the election be held in the second half of the year. And recapping one of our top stories, a U.S. destroyer shot down drones and missiles launched by Yemen's Houthi rebels toward it and the Red Sea. And that's according to the U.S. Military Central Command on early Tuesday. Meanwhile, the Indian Navy released footage of its sailors fighting a fire aboard a container ship that was targeted by the Houthis in the Gulf of Aden Monday. Smoke poured out of one container aboard the vessel, which also showed scorch marks from the impact from a Houthi missile. You'll find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Super Tuesday isn't so super.
In this election, there might not be a choice. You may have a replay of the 2020 election between the president and the former president.
Election crime trials underway in Nigeria.
Defendants are facing charges such as vote buying, stealing and destroying election materials, disorderly conduct at election venues, willful neglect of duty, possession of firearms, and election-related violence.
And Hugh Jackman and Charlie Puth talk global poverty.
Pot meets policy, so leveraging popular culture in order to accelerate the big policies needed to end extreme poverty.
Today is Wednesday, March 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. For nearly 40 years, the day called Super Tuesday in the U.S. presidential election process was important because so many votes are cast on this one day. It was a make-or-break moment for many campaigns. This year is different. The two leading candidates, incumbent Joe Biden and Donald Trump, were the presumptive nominees of their parties going into the very first contests. However, we can use Super Tuesday to drill down a bit and get a glimpse of what people who did come out and cast their vote are thinking. Here's Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam, who's focused on one of the states holding a Super Tuesday election, the only one of the group that is an actual battleground state, North Carolina.
Voters in 15 states and a U.S. territory cast their ballots on Super Tuesday, the biggest voting day of the primary season. Donald Trump is aiming for another dominant performance against Nikki Haley, his lone challenger for the Republican presidential nomination, while President Joe Biden is expected to win Tuesday's Democratic contests easily. The results in North Carolina will be closely watched for signs of each candidate's strength, as it's one of the potential battleground states that could decide the November general election. Here's what some voters in that state are saying.
We're both supporting President Biden. I think he is, yes, he is elderly,
he is older.
But you know what? I think he's done some amazing things for the country right now.
I want to vote for Trump because I think he's conservative. He was pro-life, and I think he did a whole lot for the country when he was president.
Biden is a great guy, Democrat, but at the same time, we're looking for change. We're also trying to find what's the common ground going forward. With war.
The war between Hamas and Israel was weighing on students at North Carolina University on the eve of the primary, many of whom saw a likely rematch between Biden and Trump.
I don't think either candidate represents me or my interests or our people's interests. I think Joe Biden isn't fit for office. Don't like that he's supporting a genocide right now, so.
I don't agree with really anything Trump does. But I feel like, especially during the Biden administration these past 4 years, a lot of things like haven't gotten done that he said he would, or like I haven't seen a lot of work there, like with the overturning of Roe v. Wade and with like the whole Israel-Palestine conflict right now. I'm not like super satisfied with where that is.
Sloan Duvall is the university's Young Democrats president.
These people who are saying, oh, I'm not going to vote for Joe Biden because of this one issue, I think we really need to look at the larger picture. And, you know, not voting is voting for Trump. We need to give Joe Biden credit for all he's done for young people.
North Carolina allows voters who are unaffiliated with a party to participate in any primary they choose. That could boost Nikki Haley's performance, given her relative strength with independent voters compared to Trump, who faces 4 criminal trials. Trump has pleaded not guilty in every case and has called the prosecutions politically motivated. While Trump can't win enough delegates on Tuesday to formally clinch the nomination, a strong showing would essentially end any remaining sliver of suspense. Tuesday's contests will award more than one-third of Republican delegates and more than 70% of the number needed to secure the nomination.
Reuters correspondent Chris Dignam. Joining us now from a polling place in the U.S. state of Virginia is VOA's Carolyn Pursuti. So you're at a precinct in Virginia. What's it been like? Have there been a lot of people coming in? What's their mood?
There haven't been a lot of people, Scott, but certainly it's been a constant
constant arrival of voters who are very anxious to cast their ballots, knowing how important Super Tuesday is. A lot of people I talked to said that they had various issues. They say that their main issue is, one man said it was the deficit. Another woman said it's the border. And another first-time voter that I spoke to said she voted for Marianne Williamson over President Joe Biden, one, because she's a woman. And this first-time voter said her number one issue is reproductive rights. So I thought that was very interesting to hear from that first-time voter. Another man said, I'm a Democrat, but I considered asking for a Republican ballot, which is permissible in Virginia, because I want to make sure that the America is preserved as we know it. He said that means essentially leadership that is not Donald Trump. He ended up voting for President Joe Biden, but he said either way would achieve that goal, and that was his number one issue in his vote.
One of the things you hear a lot, certainly from the pundit class, is people are unhappy with the choice because, you know, unless something extraordinary happens, it's going to be a Joe Biden, Donald Trump general election. Are people grumbling about that? Or are they talking about it at all?
Yes, absolutely. I hear that a lot, especially the younger voters. The 17-year-old that I spoke to, she's allowed to vote in the primary because, of course, she'll be 18 by the general election. But she said, we need younger voices. She said, that's why I really didn't want to vote for Biden or Trump. And that's why another reason why I voted for Williamson. Another woman who was 22 said, I'm tired of voting for people who don't understand what I'm going through. So you're certainly hearing that. You're also hearing that from older people. But in this election, there might not be a choice. You may have a replay of the 2020 election between the president and the former president. That's the type of election it will probably turn out to be.
Which actually might happen fairly quickly, right? Because Biden has no real competition, and Trump is closing in on that number.
As big as today is, Super Tuesday being the biggest event with the most states voting, we could see another big event next Tuesday. And that's when former President Trump could actually sew up the Republican nomination. Because if you add everything together and you do the math, he could end up with the number of delegates needed by next Tuesday when four states vote to then be the official nominee of the Republican Party.
VOA's Carolyn Pursuti inside a polling place in Virginia. While it has widely been reported that immigration is the top issue for voters in the United States, new data shows that is not totally true. For example, in Alabama, many Democratic primary voters on Tuesday told the news service Reuters they were deeply concerned by the state's high court ruling last month that frozen embryos produced as part of in vitro fertilization treatments were children, a ruling that threatened to undermine access to the procedure. Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman tells us about what they found at the polling places in Alabama.
For some voters here in Alabama's state capital, Montgomery, one issue was top of mind as they went to the ballot booth on Tuesday. Reproductive freedom, after a recent state court ruling that could undercut access to in vitro fertilization, or IVF.
It's been a very scary time recently.
Drew Waldrop is a 37-year-old Democratic voter.
I know people who are in the midst of going through IVF treatment who have been effectively shut down right now, and it's, you know, my heart breaks for them, honestly, and that is a big reason that I went out and voted in the Democratic primary today.
Alabama's high court last month ruled that frozen embryos created by IVF treatments should be considered children. That forced many fertility clinics to pause offering the service, and that pause pushed some voters to the polls. Jessica Rush is a Biden supporter.
So many people out here that are trying to have children, and they're using IVF. And right now, because of the IVF ruling, basically the companies that store it, help people, you know, make the babies, they're pushing pause because it's easy for somebody to, you know, make a mistake.
Callie Johnson is a nurse.
I think that basically those are those ladies' eggs, letting them do what they want to do with them.
Democrats have said the Alabama court ruling is part of a Republican-led effort to curtail reproductive rights, which hinged on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn what had been a constitutional right to abortion. Some Republicans, facing a backlash, have promised to preserve access to IVF. At least one clinic in the state has decided to continue operating as usual, with an exception. Dr. Andrew Harper with Huntsville Reproductive Medicine says his office will no longer discard embryos for now.
For us, we said we're going to continue with essentially all as we were over a fortnight ago, just, you know, conventional IVF, what just be standards of practice, how it's been done, our 20th year in practice, save for, you know, discarding potentially viable embryos, whether fresh or frozen.
And Harper says he's trying to stay out of the political fight.
I'm the clinician. I'm just here to help patients, so I'm going to let them settle all that.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. Following these other stories from around the world, Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry landed in Puerto Rico on Tuesday. The Associated Press reported, citing anonymous official sources, amid questions over his whereabouts following a trip to Kenya, during which a conflict in Haiti dramatically escalated. Venezuelans will go to the polls on July 28th to choose a president. The Electoral Authority made that announcement on Tuesday. Incumbent Nicolas Maduro is widely expected to run, and his main challenger has been precluded from running. South Korea's consumer inflation accelerated in February after 3 months of easing and was faster than market expectations. Official data showed on Wednesday that the consumer price index rose 3.1% in February from the same month the year before. Nigeria began trials this week for hundreds of people, including members of the country's electoral commission, accused of committing offenses related to last year's general elections. Timothy Obizu reports from Abuja.
Trials for 190 people, including electoral body officials and members of the major political parties, opened in courts across the country on Monday. Lawyers from Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, are serving as the prosecutor at the trials, with attorneys with the Nigerian Bar Association providing the defense. The INEC says the trials will serve as deterrents in future elections. God Bless Atuburi, founder of the pro-democracy nonprofit Ready to Lead Africa, says civic society groups welcome the trials but hope they are not just for show.
What we want to see is beyond just the announcement of trial. It is securing conviction.
Defendants are facing charges such as vote buying, stealing and destroying election materials, disorderly conduct at election venues, willful neglect of duty, possession of firearms and election-related violence. Such infractions are unfortunately common in Nigeria before, during and after the polls. In last year's general elections, police say more than 20 people were killed in violence related to the elections. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Germany said Tuesday that human error is to blame for Russia obtaining a telephone recording of senior German military officials talking about supplying long-range weapons to Ukraine. Berlin denied its systems had been hacked. Henry Ridgewell reports from London that Western allies fear what else Russia may know from other conversations.
Germany's defense minister Boris Pistorius said Tuesday that government communication systems had not been compromised. Pistorius said the reason that the phone call could still be recorded in the ranks of the Air Force is due to an individual application error. Not all participants adhered to the secure dialing procedure as prescribed, he added. Western allies are questioning what other intelligence Russia was able to gather. Marina Miron of King's College London.
What we don't know is what else do they know? This is the one call that they decided to reveal. And probably Russia knows about all deliveries, where they are taking place. And this is very, very serious.
The recording was published on the same day of the funeral of the late Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny. Analysts say the timing was likely aimed at diverting global attention. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, London.
International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Indirect talks on an end to hostilities along the Lebanese-Israeli border will begin during Ramadan, which starts next week. That's from Lebanon's caretaker prime minister. The powerful armed Lebanese group Hezbollah and Israel have been exchanging fire for nearly 5 months, parallel with the Gaza war. Australia recommitted to working alongside the Association of Southeastern Asian Nations leaders at a leaders' plenary on Wednesday as part of the ASEAN-Australia Special Summit held in Melbourne.
In all this, Australia commits to working with you to make sure the principles of sovereignty, territorial integrity, equality, and independence are upheld. To ensure our region is secure, resilient, open, inclusive and prosperous. The regional architecture, with ASEAN at its centre, is vital in pursuing these goals and for promoting trust and transparency among our nations.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, Australia is hosting the three-day summit to mark 50 years since it became ASEAN's first external partner. It will look to bolster ties with the fast-growing region as China looks to increase its diplomatic and military reach. And finally, the organization Global Citizen is holding its first international edition of its Global Citizen Now conference in Melbourne this week. It says the event is bringing together more than 300 young leaders with world leaders, including World Bank President Ajay Banga and former United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Celebrities, including Global Citizen Ambassadors Hugh Jackman and Charlie Puth, as well as the rock band Crowded House, also there. VOA's Lori London talked with co-founder Michael Sheldrick about the event.
Thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for giving us the opportunity. We're grateful.
For those people who may not know about Global Citizen as an organization, tell us a bit about what your main goals and objectives are.
Thank you very much. For the first time in a generation, we've seen around the world the number of people living in extreme poverty rising. And Global Citizen, we're one of the world's leading international advocacy organizations on a mission to end extreme poverty now. And we're powered by a worldwide community of everyday citizen advocates. Our membership is 12 million, and it's people around the world who raise their voices and take action. And the movement is amplified by campaigns and events that convene leaders in music, entertainment, public policy, media, philanthropy, and the corporate sector. We often say at our core is the idea of pop meets policy, so leveraging popular culture in order to accelerate the big policies needed to end extreme poverty. And over the last decade or so, Global Citizen has helped ignite over 33 million citizen actions that, together with some remarkable partners that we work with around the world, has resulted in over $43 billion being distributed to incredible grassroots organizations, UN organizations working around the world. And they together have helped impact the lives of over 1.2 billion people. And we were first established a decade and a half ago in 2008. And today our operations expand from New York, Washington, D.C., L.A., London, Paris, Berlin, Geneva, Melbourne, Toronto, Johannesburg, Lagos, and beyond.
You've got a big new conference to team young people with very big named world leaders trying to reach the U.N. Sustainable Development Goals. Why did you decide to do this, and why is it important to connect young change makers with world leaders?
Yeah, so between the 4th and 6th of March, as Australia hosts the leaders from across Southeast Asia in Melbourne, Global Citizen Now Melbourne is looking to drive the urgent action needed on the biggest challenges the world is facing. And, you know, at no other gatherings like a Global Citizen event do you see citizens engaging and interacting with leaders, heads of state, leaders in business and entertainment. And we've got some of the biggest names from Hugh Jackman, Charlie Puth, to Ajay Banga, president of the World Bank, to Crowded House and the Duchess of York, Sarah Ferguson, participating in this summit. But as you noted, you know, the greatest movements in the world have often been shaped and initiated by young people. And so we're bringing together 32 young innovators from across the Asia Pacific region who are impacting their local communities in the fight to end extreme poverty. And together with our partners, we're providing these youth innovators with direct financial support, with cash grants, and we're supporting them with networking and bilateral opportunities to further scale their efforts. And just to give you a snapshot of who some of these remarkable young people are, one of them is Bianca Manon. She's an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander campaigner. She's 29 years old, and she's being recognized for her work in leading Aboriginal-led development programs and driving awareness of how we can be led by the original custodians of the land to better care for the country. And she's one of the leaders in the justice campaign area known as Common Grace. We also have leaders in Nepal, from New Zealand, from Sri Lanka, from all around the world joining us in Melbourne.
You're focusing on poverty. Your organization also, the three main areas that you target are poverty, equity, and the planet. I would imagine, since they're so interconnected, the challenges are really important to offering future generations hope, because they are exactly really facing monumental global problems to change.
Well, 100%. What we see currently around the world is climate change is already having an impact. It's ravaging the world's most vulnerable countries and communities. These are communities who contributed the least to the crisis, and yet they're being impacted the hardest.
Global Citizen's Michael Sheldrick talking with VOA's Lori London. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. And you can also download the VOA app. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Joe Biden announced the United States will provide additional food and supplies for Palestinians in Gaza by conducting airdrops to counter the dire humanitarian situation there. The United States is also working to find ways to open a maritime corridor as an additional pathway for assistance. Innocent lives are on the line, President Biden said. We're trying to pull out every stop we can to get more assistance in. On March 2nd, the United States made its first humanitarian assistance airdrop into Gaza in a joint operation with Jordan. Three U.S. Air Force cargo planes dropped 66 pallets that held 38,000 ready-to-eat meals. National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby said that the first airdrop is intended to be part of a sustained effort. He emphasized that airdrops will supplement, not replace, delivery on the ground. While airdrops have the advantage of speed, he pointed out that military aircraft cannot replicate the size and scale and scope of a convoy of 20 or 30 trucks. With $180 million of assistance, the United States is the largest provider of aid to the people of Gaza and the West Bank since the onset of the conflict October 7th, when Hamas killed 1,200 Israelis and took more than 240 people hostage. In response, the Israeli military has gone into Gaza to destroy Hamas. Thousands of Palestinians have been killed, and famine is looming. At a briefing, a U.S. official stated that the problem with humanitarian assistance reaching the people of Gaza is distribution, exacerbated by the actions of criminal gangs, taking it, looting it, reselling it. The way to solve the problem, the official said, is to flood the market, bring in assistance from every point you can, demonetize these commodities. Advisor Kirby noted that the desperation of the people of Gaza made tragically manifest days ago when scores were killed rushing a convoy of aid trucks underscores the terrible need for more aid. It is also why the United States is working so hard on a deal between Israel and Hamas that would trigger a six-week ceasefire. Such a deal would allow a surge in the flow of aid, the release of hostages, and a reduction in violence. As State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said, a deal is on the table. Hamas should accept it immediately.
That was an editorial reflecting the view.